we can be an incubator and we can help other researchers collaborate and work together. And we do that through funding, but they might not have had that opportunity if they hadn't been working with us and some other organizations. Mm-hmm. So I always figure it this way. Anyone living with ALS does not care where this cure comes from, does not care where meaningful treatments come from. That's right. There should be no bounds to that. So we're going to fund the best research, no matter where that is.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the fifth episode of Connecting ALS. As always, I'm your host, Mike Stevenson, from the Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota chapter of the ALS Association. If you sense the excitement in my voice, it's because we were able to connect with two very influential figures in the world of ALS for this episode. We first met with the ALS Association's president and CEO, Colonit Balas, who gave us a window into what the greater organization is working on, including how global research is funded and tracked. Colonit is also the chair of the board for the International Alliance of ALS MND Associations, so it was really interesting to discuss a range of topics with her. That interview is followed by a phone conversation with Dr. Nathan Staff from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Staff is deeply involved in ALS research and knows the ins and outs of that universe as well as anyone I've ever met. And we managed to pack quite a bit into our brief call. So make sure you give that a listen as well. All right, let's jump right into our first segment with Colonit Balas. We are joined in studio this morning by a very special guest in from Washington, D.C. at our national office, the ALS Association's president and CEO, Colonit Balas. Colonit, good morning, and thanks for joining us on Connecting ALS.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
There are so many topics I want to get into, but for our listeners who may not know your full story and history, can you provide a little bit of background about your career and how you ended up at the ALS Association?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So like many things in life, it's been a long and windy road. Mm-hmm. I've lived in Washington now for, I think, close to 15 years or so, but wow. I actually grew up in Iowa. So I'm from Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Right.
And like I said, I went to Washington about 15 years ago. I've been in nonprofit that whole time. I used to be the equivalent of an executive director at the Arthritis Foundation for the Metro DC chapter for about 5 or 6 years, I guess. And
sure.
Then that organization did some regionalizing. I served as the chief strategy officer for a few years after that for what was then the Mid-Atlantic region. So it was several states from Delaware down to South Carolina.
Oh, okay.
And then I was asked to come and run the Ovarian Cancer National Alliance. And I did that for a few years, which was really amazing.
I'm sure.
And we went through some merging and some other really great opportunities for that community. And during that time, the Ice Bucket Challenge happened. And a former colleague of mine, who is now my predecessor, asked me if I would come and start working with the ALS Association and tried to work on mission strategy, which I did. I eventually became the executive vice president of mission strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So really with the goal of integrating all of our mission pillars together on a national level across the country. And then about a year and a half ago or so, the board asked me to take this job. And it's amazing. It's an amazing job, an amazing organization. So that's the short of my story.
No, that's great. That's great.
Hope that answers your question.
It does. And,
okay.
And we feel lucky to have you at the helm.
That's
I
kind.
Know families in this region that have been greatly comforted by your leadership at the ALS Association. And speaking of the association,
sure.
Our mission, of course, is to discover treatments and a cure for ALS, and to serve, advocate for, and empower people affected by ALS to live their lives to the fullest.
Right.
There are a number of ALS organizations doing some fantastic work mm-hmm. in the space, but that mission, the ALS Association, are we in a unique position in terms of addressing the disease from multiple fronts?
We are in a very unique position, and that actually is what sets us apart from other organizations.
Mm.
I always say that the ALS Association is the only organization in our country that serves the mission as what I call a 360. So we have a lot of other great organizations that might be focused in one area or another.
Yep.
But we're trying to attack on all fronts by providing funding for research. We're the largest funder in the world for research outside of the NIH, private funder. Mm-hmm. We, you know, obviously do public policy and advocacy work, and that happens on a national level, but also in some of our states as well.
It's a big part of it.
And it's a big part of making sure that people have access to treatment and care. And then, of course, we provide care on the ground. And I'm sure many people here have benefited from those services, and those are things we'll want to keep doing. And we're also very uniquely positioned because we serve as a global leader. And now, you may or may not be aware, I chair also the International Alliance.
Yeah.
And I have come to learn how important the role of this organization is, not just within our country, but how people are looking at us from around the world. So we are quite uniquely positioned.
I can imagine. How has that experience been with the National Alliance, getting to meet others from around the globe and hear about what they're working on and how it's progressing? I'm sure that's been exciting.
Oh, it's fascinating. It really is. And what it has shown me is how fortunate we are. And there's so much work that still needs to be done in so many countries, including our own, of course. Mm-hmm. But I've learned from people. I've learned from my colleagues in other countries. I've learned how we can think about sharing resources and how we can think about maybe even reinterpreting some of those resources, like almost literally, you know, translation and things. There are a lot of things that we have that people in other countries are desperate to get their hands on. And so it's been a really fascinating experience, one that I really like quite a bit.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Ice Bucket Challenge earlier, and we're now 5 years removed from that, amazingly. That, of course, was the moment that changed the course of ALS research and care forever. For many that were a part of that original challenge, they hear and see the dollar amounts that were raised from that event, and it's natural for them to ask questions like, where did all that money end up?
Sure.
And how much closer are we really to meaningful treatments? The answers are obviously pretty complex.
Yeah.
But how do you best explain the impact of that original Ice Bucket Challenge?
The Ice Bucket Challenge is a catalyst, and probably one that we won't even understand for many years to come as to what that long-term impact will be. I can say that when we look at how much research is now being done, it's significantly more. And I would encourage everyone who's listening to go onto our website, because we have listed out where all of the dollars have been spent.
Yep.
So you can take a look at all the research and the care services and everything that we've spent. We've actually spent more money on mission since the Ice Bucket Challenge than was raised in the Ice Bucket Challenge.
Wow.
So sometimes it is complex. People think we still have all this money. We're actually doing really well on raising money too. And that's important because we want to keep infusing those dollars into research and all the care and everything that we need to do. When you ask the question of, are we closer to meaningful treatment? We really are. Some of the things that I really enjoy doing are going to the research conferences. And if you like research and you're a little nerdy like me, you like to see how excited these researchers are, which is significantly different than where they were just a few years ago.
Yes.
We have three treatments now in phase three clinical trials. That's not
huge
happened.
News.
That's huge. We have over 20 treatments in phase two clinical trials. I firmly believe that we are very, very close in the next several years to some meaningful treatments coming out for the community. I'm very excited about it.
That's amazing.
It is.
And it's really, you kind of alluded to about sustaining that momentum.
Right.
The catalyst is such a perfect word, and that initiated this huge kind of snowball effect where we started to make more progress than had been made in the previous three decades in about a three-year stretch. And now we're seeing some of those fruits come to bear and real progress on the research side. And I know that we haven't quite yet achieved that major breakthrough that everyone is hoping for and waiting for, but it definitely feels closer than it's ever been.
It's definitely closer than it's been. And what we see is, you know, when we put money in to research, so do others, right? So for example, we have already completely spent $40 million in research. And what I mean by that is most research grants are multi-year,
yep.
right? So we are still in the process of spending another nearly $50 million, but that it takes time to for yeah. that to happen. That $40 million leveraged another $120 million into our space.
Wow.
That's brand new,
yeah.
right? So when I say that there's a lot more happening, there really is. And there are a lot more researchers working together. There are a lot more researchers in the space, and there are more dollars going into our space. So catalyst is why I use that word.
Yeah. And thank you for clarifying, because I think for some folks, particularly people like me with a limited understanding of research, the concept of milestone-based research funding
right.
can be a little confusing. But mm-hmm. having gathered all those resources following the Ice Bucket Challenge, it would not have been wise to pour all that immediately into current projects, correct? You want to ensure that things are progressing the way you want them to and need them to, and you fund it as it goes along in multi-year trials and phases. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So what happens, we did immediately put a lot of funding into research mm-hmm. that we knew was going unfunded,
right?
And so Project Mine is a perfect example of that, mm-hmm. that we pivoted within a couple of months and started putting resources there.
Yeah.
But what we did not want to do was to put, let's say, $100 million
mm-hmm.
into one potential therapy.
Yep.
And if that didn't work out,
right.
where would we be?
Exactly.
Right? So we came up with a research strategy all across the board. So that goes from our fellows that are just starting out in the field, and we want to make sure that we provide enough funding for them to stay in the field
mm-hmm.
and continue to be researchers long-term,
mm-hmm.
all the way through phase two clinical trials, right? And milestone funding is just a common practice of research because you want to achieve a certain outcome. And if you can show that you can achieve it, then that next phase of funding comes. And sometimes we have studies that they go along and they get a year, 18 months into it, and they recognize, nope, we're not going to achieve that milestone.
Sure.
It would be unwise then to spend more money in something that's not working.
Right.
So then we pivot and we put dollars back to where we think they might work.
Constantly reevaluating and making sure that we're investing the right way.
Always.
That's
yeah.
great to hear.
Yeah.
I hear the world is our lab when referencing
yes.
the ALS Association mm-hmm. funded research. And I think beyond just a kind of clever way of saying it, what are the benefits of working collaboratively with scientists all over the globe?
The benefits are endless,
mm.
right? Again, back to Project Mine.
Yep.
So that is a perfect example of a global project where when we're pulling resources from all across the world, now we're able to take a look and say, okay, can we find new genetic markers? And mm. we did, right? We found several
yep.
since that has started. Additionally, we can be an incubator, and we can help other researchers collaborate and work together. And we do that through funding, but they might not have had that opportunity if they hadn't been working with us and some other organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So I always figure it this way. Anyone living with ALS does not care where this cure comes from, does not care where meaningful treatments come
That's
from.
Right.
There should be no bounds to that. So we're going to fund the best research no matter where that is.
No, that's a great way of framing it. And we're talking a lot about research.
Yeah.
Colony, you mentioned the website.
Mm-hmm.
I want to encourage anyone that wants to learn more about the progress being made and where the association is investing. Visit alsa.org/research. There's a ton of great information on there. There's a research toolkit on there. Colony mentioned the list of current projects and studies that are being funded. A ton of really wonderful data that you can mine on that website.
An opportunity to find clinical trials, get involved. So I would underscore everything
yeah.
you just said.
Yeah, of yeah. course, of course. And finding those trials is a big part of it. Access for folks that are looking for those trials is key. Clearly, funding and guiding research, big part of what the ALS Association does, but we shouldn't overlook the programs and services provided to individuals and families by chapters across the country. There's innovation happening in that arena as well. What do you feel like has changed in terms of care and support over the last few years?
Well, you're completely right. We should not overlook our care services programs across the country. They're some of the most important things that we do.
Mm-hmm.
And providing help to individuals and their families every day. I think there are probably two areas in which I've seen significant change.
Yeah.
One is technology.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been able to take a lot of that ice bucket money and also invest in technology, whether that's voice banking. We've been doing some research with Python technology, which is really cool stuff.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
So check that out if you're interested. And then the other is we've been able to support so many new clinics. So we have, I think, more than doubled the amount of clinics across the country that we are supporting. We went from 33, I think, certified treatment centers to now over 60 certified treatment centers. We added recognized treatment centers as a new program. So we're actually working with over 120 clinics across the country in different levels. And that is, when you talk about access, that's some of the most important work that we can do, is to make sure that those centers have resources that they need to help people every day living with ALS all across the country.
Tremendously important. And for folks that are maybe living in rural areas or a little bit kind of outside the major metropolitan regions, needing clinics that they can get to meet with doctors and clinicians who can specify and help them with their disease progression is key.
Right.
Because if you have to drive 6 hours for a clinical visit and then 6 hours back, that's really going to change.
Yeah. And what happens in many of those situations is that people stop going to clinic.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes expensive. Often they have to drive that 6 hours. They're staying overnight in a hotel, driving back. And of course, just the wear and tear on people. So I hope, and I'm starting to see a lot of also technology used to help people at a distance. And we're starting to think about that and how we do telehealth and more opportunities for potentially underwriting telehealth and opportunities for, I'm hoping, to get insurance coverage and things like that so that that becomes a real option for people.
Telehealth, a big topic and across medicine right now. And I think we've probably mentioned it on each episode of the podcast that we've had, because it's on people's minds. And again, it comes down to a question of accessibility.
Right.
And because technology's improved so much over the last 4 or 5 years, that you can now do so much on a tablet, whether that's an iPad or an Android tablet or even your phone.
Yeah.
Being able to connect via video, speak to doctors, speak to clinicians, talk about what you're going through, that's a game changer.
Yeah, it could be a big game changer. I know it's something that parts of the VA are looking into. There are other clinicians around the country that are looking into. And I do know of a clinician who was recently working on trying to do a clinical trial through telemedicine. And talk about a game changer there. So I think the options are, and the opportunities are really high, and that's exciting.
It is. Yeah. And the technology, just on a global scale, everything changes so exponentially from month to month. So I think we're all benefiting from those changes, and hopefully that just means better care and easier access for families living with ALS.
Exactly.
I also want to talk a little bit about advocacy, because as you said, that is another pillar of the ALS Association's work. On previous episodes, we have talked to people living with ALS about what they're hopeful for on both the state and federal levels.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that the ALS Association is prioritizing from a legislative standpoint at the moment?
So first, we always prioritize funding, research funding, and that will be a staple that we will continue to fight for every year until we don't need it anymore. And I'm excited for that day too.
Yeah.
And then we always focus on if there are going to be any barriers to access. So for example, a couple of years ago, there was a barrier to some complex rehab technology that was being proposed. And so we worked in coalition. We fought against that.
Yeah.
We won. And that's very important. And now we're seeing a similar barrier being proposed for ventilation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a big priority for us this year. Again, we're working in coalition and we are seeing traction for sure.
Yep.
Another big initiative that we've been pushing for about 2 years now is waiving that SSDI 5-month waiting period.
Income,
and we are also starting to see some really good traction, certainly in the House and even in the Senate. So the question is, can we get it through?
Right.
You know, that's what I hope your listeners and people across the country keep pounding the pavement or pounding the keyboard and sending into their members of Congress to let them understand how important those are. And, you know, our issues change all of the time. We're always trying to make sure that there's going to be access to therapies. And I do believe on the horizon, as we start to see, hopefully, those treatments come to fruition, we're going to have to do a lot of work to make sure people have access to those treatments
right.
and they're affordable. And that's probably one of my biggest concerns at this point.
Yeah, I'm sure. And it has to be something of a benefit to be where the association is headquartered in D.C. to have access to those legislators to say, you know, we're still here.
And oh,
we're going to keep bugging you until we get what we want and need. And that's probably a nice thing to have that kind of access to them.
Yeah, it's really important. And it's important just like anything for relationship building. Mm-hmm. So they know us. You know, we work with not only people on the Hill, but a lot of our agencies work very closely with FDA
sure.
and, you know, NIH and others. So that kind of access is really important. So we're always in the forefront of legislators' minds as mm-hmm. well as agencies. And mm-hmm. and that helps us a lot.
And as you said, for the individuals and families that are living with ALS, it's so critical for them to keep doing all that they can in terms of reaching out and making noise and letting our legislators know that these are really important issues that impact a ton of people around the country, and they're not going to go away until we have their help.
That's right. And I always say, you know, like I said, I've been living in Washington for 15 mm-hmm. years. I'm always going to advocate for people living with ALS, and I'd advocate for others as well.
Yeah.
But the legislators listen to people who live in their districts.
That's right.
And they need to know that this issue is actually important to the people who are living in their district. And
mm-hmm.
sometimes I get the question, you know, these form letters, do they really matter,
mm-hmm.
you know? And you can always change the form letters a little if you
yeah.
want to personalize them. But they do, because what happens in a congressman's office is they count how mm. many people have actually contacted us about this issue.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the quote unquote, the olden days when people actually sent in snail
right,
mail,
right, mailing
they literally would pile them on the table
oh,
and,
sure.
and keep account of which issues they were hearing from constituents.
Yeah.
Now they just keep an electronic tally,
yeah.
but it's the same thing. So
yeah.
hearing from people living in the district, living in the state is as if not more important than hearing from staff in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely. It all adds up.
Yep.
Speaking of hearing from folks in the ALS community, we have the privilege of talking to folks in our region about how the association is providing support to them and what else we can do to help. You, of course, experience that on a much larger scale at the national level. What is it, I suppose, beyond aggressively funding and supporting research, which we know the association will continue to do, but what are people hoping that the ALS Association can help with down the road?
Yeah. So we do ask this question, and we ask it from people all over across the country. We do community surveys mm-hmm. every other year. We also have a program that we're recently starting, which is called ALS Prefer, and it's about preference, you know?
Oh,
yeah. And so it's actually now morphed into a much larger program called ALS Focus. And with that, what do we focus on? Right, and how do we work with folks in Washington to help make that happen? And I will say the number one thing that I hear about is home care.
I bet.
The ability to secure it, the ability to pay for it, and making sure that home care continues forward as someone needs in the way that they want.
Yes.
Right? That, I think, is probably going to be not probably, it will be one of the number one issues that we will continue mm-hmm. to tackle for quite some time to come. So whether that's through a legislative process, through working with Medicare and Medicaid or CMS,
yep.
also working with home care agencies mm-hmm. and educating the agencies on what is reimbursable and what's not, those are things that we'll be very focused on for quite a while.
Home care is so critical, and it's such a costly thing to provide. So understanding the needs of the ALS community, and as your disease progresses, that you're going to require more intensive care and more attentive care, and having access to that key. So if we can find a way to fund that, I'm sure that's top of mind for so many folks.
It really is. And we hear from so many people who have lost a lot,
mm-hmm.
whether that's completely gone bankrupt or yeah. lost their homes, trying to keep, you know, this service available to their loved one.
Mm-hmm.
It's really unfortunate, but we're not the only
yes.
community that faces this, but
yep.
for our work, it's some of the most difficult.
Yeah, it's a big one.
Yeah.
My last question for you, Colonite, going to ask you to look into your crystal ball. I know.
I don't have that, and I don't have a magic wand, but if you have one, I'm up for it.
I know that no one can predict when that next breakthrough is going to happen that may lead to an effective treatment for ALS. For anyone living with a disease, time is obviously against them.
Right.
But as someone who is deeply involved with the strategic planning and shaping the next phase of support for those in need, for what kind of future are you preparing the organization?
Yeah. So as an organization, we're going through a lot of transformation, right? The ice bucket, again, kind of infused that opportunity. And what I'm looking at is when those treatments come to fruition, can we as an organization continue to support at the level that we're at, if not higher, more people living with ALS? That's the goal. Right? That's the dream. So that's what we're driving to the hoop. We're going to drive toward making sure that our organization has enough bandwidth to support more people living with this disease. And that's going to take a lot more resources. It'll probably take some different thinking too for us. You know, we don't know what those future needs might look like. Some of the things we do now might not even be relevant. You know, we might need more of what we do. Maybe we need more DME loan closets across the country, right? We need more services going out and checking on people. So that's my crystal ball future look is, how do we as an organization scale up and ramp up to make sure we can serve all people living with ALS?
And I've heard other neurologists and experts in the field say something similar, where when we do have that breakthrough and we have a treatment that's going to slow the disease down for a large portion of the population, it's a good problem to have, obviously, but the result will be more people living with the disease for longer periods of time and higher quality of life. So as you said, it'll just be an adjustment. How do we both maintain the current level of service and increase the level of service for a larger population?
Right. And how do we make sure that the services that we're providing are the services people need? And that might look a little different. And I was actually recently speaking with a couple of people saying that we're talking with folks at MS and other organizations, and where those disease communities really experienced a big shift over the last 10 or 20 years. And how do we kind of borrow their playbook a little bit and say, what did you experience and how can we prepare our organization and understand what might be in the road ahead?
The fact that we're even having this conversation is so great.
It is.
Because even 4 or 5 years ago, there's no way we'd have been able to speak about this confidently, and that we're talking about it now, it's a good thing.
It is a great thing.
Well, it's been really great to have you on the podcast, Colonite, to address things from a national perspective at the ALS Association. Thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me. And this has been a pleasure. And for those of you who are in the area, I highly encourage you to come see this new office space.
Oh, sure.
It is amazing. I'm a little jealous, I have to admit. But anyway, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I hope you appreciated hearing from Colonite on how the ALS Association continues to address this disease on every front, and why furthering research remains one of our highest priorities. Speaking of research, I mentioned we'd be connecting with ALS researcher and neurologist Dr. Nathan Staff at the Mayo Clinic, so let's transition directly into that interview. On the phone with us this morning from the globally recognized Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, is Dr. Nathan Staff. Good morning, doctor. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning.
So in addition to overseeing the well-known ALS clinic at Mayo, Dr. Staff studies disorders that damage the peripheral nervous system, ALS among them. And clinical trials in ALS are one of his focus areas, so we figured who better to talk to about that very subject. And before I start peppering you with the additional questions I have, doctor, are you able to tell us a little bit about the research you are currently involved in at Mayo, knowing that, of course, there are some details that you can't really get into?
Sure, happy to. So, you know, I think two major efforts that we're undertaking here at Mayo Clinic in Rochester are, one, we're doing stem cell trials for ALS. So we're both involved in the phase 3 Brainstorm Neurone Trial, which is a large multi-center study that's looking at the benefits and safety of repeated injections of mesenchymal stem cells, the neurone product, in patients with ALS. And we also have a study that's a phase two study looking at adipose or fat-derived mesenchymal stem cells delivered to patients with ALS. Another major effort that we have is collecting biosamples and providing clinical information about those biosamples. We collaborate closely with Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, who is an internationally known center for pathomechanisms of ALS disease, both with Drs. Len Petrocelli and Rosa Rademachers there. Mm. And so we provide them with samples so they can better understand why ALS occurs and what things we can do to try to prevent it and treat it.
Sure, sure. Well, thank you for giving us descriptions of those. I want to ask some more specifics about stem cells and other things specifically. But first, just more broadly, talking about ALS research, there is a distinct difference between hope and optimism. And both words are used pretty regularly in the world of ALS research. And I know that we're all hopeful for a turning point in the near future, the major breakthrough that is going to change how we treat and talk about ALS. But the word optimism keeps coming up when I mention research, and it seems to mean something different to everybody. Let me ask you, Dr. Staff, what are you most optimistic about in the ALS research space?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple things that really lend themselves to being more optimistic about ALS research than we may have been in the past. I think one is that we are definitely understanding the disease better. Mm. You know, there's large amount of research groups that are focusing in on mechanisms of how ALS occurs, both from figuring out the genetics of ALS, but also the kind of the cell biology of how different things happen within the cell that lead to motor neuron death. And it's being really approached from an amazing number of areas. You know, some of it is in animal models, some of it is cell models that are from patient-derived sources. There's the samples that patients provide when they're in clinic and volunteering for research efforts. And then there's also more basic models, such as Drosophila and zebrafish, that really are contributing to our knowledge about the disease. And the more we understand about the disease from a basic science standpoint, the more targeted we can be in terms of developing therapies to interrupt those pathways and hopefully, you know, treat the disease better than we're currently doing. So that's a lot of excitement. And frankly, much of that research has been supported by not only the National Institutes of Health, but also foundations such as the ALS Association, which has pumped a great deal of money into this research effort. And then I guess the second main area of optimism is that some of the therapies that are coming through currently are kind of novel approaches to going after this disease that hadn't been tried before. I think the one that probably everyone is most optimistic about is gene therapy. Mm-hmm. So in gene therapy, there are ways of actually impacting specific genes that are known to cause ALS. So there's a study now through a company called Biogen, where they're using a small molecule that is kind of like a piece of DNA that can be delivered into the spinal fluid and then goes in and actually blocks the ability of a bad gene that is known to cause ALS, specifically looking at the SOD1 mutation, which is, you know, a gene that was the first one that was described to cause ALS.
Right.
And so those trials are moving through into phase two and phase three, which are, you know, getting closer to patients. And I think part of the reason people are more optimistic about this than other therapies that we've had in the past is that this particular approach to treating a genetic disorder has been shown to be helpful in other diseases. So there are FDA-approved therapies for spinal muscular atrophy, Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, transthyretin amyloidosis, all of which have shown very clearly to have sometimes even dramatic effects on the disease, especially in the case of spinal muscular atrophy. So knowing that it works well in one disease that's a genetic disorder gives us a lot of optimism that it may be helpful for our patients that have a genetic form of ALS.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I can see why the scientific community would be excited about that potential. And I've heard you talk about the SMA kind of analogy before. And as it relates to gene therapies, when we're talking about how this could impact familial and genetic forms of the disease, those kind of therapies could also have an impact for people with sporadic ALS, correct?
Yeah, I think that, you know, as I said, the current trials are really focused on patients who have a specific mutation that's causing their ALS.
Yeah.
This sort of a therapeutic approach where small molecules are targeting specific genes could also be extended to targeting specific pathways that we are understanding to be more and more critical for the development of ALS. So, mm-hmm. you know, a gene that may be need to be shut down to help treat sporadic forms of ALS, so forms of ALS that don't have genetic bases, may still be amenable to this sort of approach. So I think there's a lot of excitement in that realm as well. It's a real targeted therapy that hasn't been able to be done before.
Right. And that, I mean, we've been talking about this summer being the fifth anniversary of the Ice Bucket Challenge and that influx of funding that had such a huge impact on the number of studies available. This development in gene therapy, we can tie that directly back to a lot of that influx of funding, right?
Definitely.
That's great. That's great. It's good to hear about the progress always. I also want to ask you about stem cells, another area of research that's really been trending in the public eye for a number of years. And I know that you're doing a lot with there at Mayo, but most people without the science background or understanding to really grasp how stem cell research is done, and I'm including myself in that group, we tend to lump it all into kind of a hazy sort of notion about how we think stem cells operate and are used in research. I guess my question is, Dr. Staff, can you describe how stem cells are commonly used in ALS trials?
Sure, no, happy to do that. So, you know, I think, you know, the term stem cell therapy obviously is a loaded term and comes with a lot of preconceived notions of what that might be. And I think oftentimes what people think stem cell therapy can provide is not currently what it's able to provide. And I think, you know, in some ways, considering rephrasing it from being a stem cell therapy to just being a cell therapy is maybe even a bit more appropriate. Mm. Because I think what's happening currently with stem cell therapy is that the cells are being used as a vehicle to provide biologic factors that may help slow down the disease. Specifically, what we've been working on, both in our project that we've started here at Mayo, but also our industry sponsor Brainstorm, is looking at a specific type of stem cell called the mesenchymal stem cell, sometimes referred to as a mesenchymal stromal cell, or MSC for short. And okay. So that particular cell is, while it is a stem cell, it's only able to turn into fat cells or cartilage or bone or connective tissue. It's not expected to turn into neurons and replace neurons, which would obviously be a great thing to have for ALS. Right. But what these MSCs are thought to do is that they can get into the nervous system and provide growth factors, so provide proteins that are known to keep neurons alive. We've lots of data on this over the years, how growth factors are helpful to keep neurons alive. But then also they can modulate the immune system. And there's significant body of evidence that's been building showing that the immune system probably does play a role in at least the rate of progression of ALS, but maybe even the pathogenesis of ALS as well. Okay. And so getting these MSCs into the body can provide growth factors, modulate the immune system, and hopefully slow down the disease. And I think, you know, as I said, MSCs can really only turn into, you know, fat cells or bone cells or connective tissue. And I think that gets sometimes thought to be similar to maybe embryonic stem cells or neuronal stem cells. Mm. And so, you know, what I like to think of stem cells as is kind of a family tree. And so kind of the original base of the family tree is the embryonic stem cell, which is, you know, the fertilized cell that can become any cell in the body. That fertilized egg can become a neuron cell, it can become a skin cell, it can become a gut cell. And it can really become anything. But as that family tree grows, there are branches that go off to different aspects of it. And then those stem cells at that level cannot become any cell in the body. They're really kind of defined to become certain types of cells. So the MSC, as I said, can become bone or cartilage. But then on the other, another tree branch may have the blood stem cells, which can become all the blood cells in the body. And so those blood stem cells are the ones that are used typically when we think of stem cell transplants for patients with leukemia or lymphoma.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that analogy. That really kind of in a simple way gives us a look at the way that stem cells are used. And it's helpful to think about it in terms of a family tree, like you said. I'm learning a lot from this conversation, and I'm sure that means our listeners are as well. The other thing before I forget that I want to mention is how much you know about platform trials. And that is, again, another kind of buzzword that seems to be popping up online and across social media. And it's something that people know we should be talking about, but don't necessarily know where to begin. So can you give us a look into platform trials and how that concept applies to ALS research?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So, you know, as I mentioned before, how the science, the basic science of understanding how ALS occurs and all the pathways and pathomechanisms of ALS disease, that science has really matured and gotten much more sophisticated over time. Mm-hmm. In the same way that that has gotten sophisticated, the science around how to conduct clinical trials has become much more sophisticated over time. So when we generally think about clinical trials, we think of it in a fairly regimented fashion. So there's a phase one study, which tends to be small numbers of patients, first time the drug's being used in human, and really looking at safety, making sure that it isn't something that's horribly unsafe to be using in humans.
Sure.
Then a phase two trial is the next phase. And there you're starting to look still at safety, but now starting to get some more information about whether there's any benefit as well. So safety and benefit, a little larger study, sometimes trying to figure out what's the right dose to use in a clinical trial. And So at the phase two level, it's a really critical stage of the drug development program, in that the phase two studies really are the time where they often are deciding whether to go forward into really trying to develop this into an FDA-approved medication.
Right.
And so oftentimes things get roadblocked in the phase two trial. The phase three trial then is kind of the penultimate trial, where it's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of patients, typically with a large placebo-controlled study following it over time, and really trying to prove whether or not there's any benefit for using that drug in a specific disease. So kind of this phase one, phase two, phase three, and then ultimately FDA approval and out into the marketplace. Platform trials are really have been aimed primarily at the phase two level. And so what's interesting about a platform trial is that it totally goes at the development of a clinical trial in a different fashion. So typically, say we have, you know, three or four drugs out there that are going into phase two trials, each of those phase two drug trials is going to have its own clinical protocol, which is really a rule book on how that trial is going to start from beginning to end. And then each of those trials is also going to have to go through an institutional review board or ethics committee. Each of those has to interact often in lengthy fashion with the FDA to get it all up and running. Oftentimes there's a lot of infrastructure that's built for each phase two clinical trial to get them off the ground. And so you've done this in four or five different drugs at the same time and really kind of, you know, honestly wasted some efforts as that's being built. Another thing that's done is that oftentimes they have placebos. So each of those groups, each of those trials is going to have a placebo arm to the trial,
right?
Which means a lot more patients aren't going to be receiving the active therapy.
Yeah.
What a platform does is, instead of having, you know, a protocol for each different drug, from the beginning what's set up is one protocol. So one kind of rule book for how the phase two platform trial is going to happen. And the infrastructure is all built for that one trial. You have the research organizations in place, you have the ethics boards in place, you have the FDA in place. All the statistics are set up in the beginning of the trial. And then what you do is you just start running the drugs through that one platform. So you can have four or five drugs that are going through this one protocol, and they can kind of come in one after the other and really increase the speed by which we can push drugs from that phase one study out to the phase three study.
Right. Right. It sounds a lot more efficient.
Yeah, no, it really is. And we've really built off of what the oncology groups have done over the years. This was started to come into play over the last decade in oncology trials. And okay. They set up all kind of the methodology and the statistics that go into this, which are actually quite complex. But ALS has really been on the forefront of non-oncologic research in terms of developing these clinical trials in a way that really is most efficient. And I should say, this is really being shepherded and led by Mass General Hospital. They're really the ones that are setting up this platform trial. But what's going to happen is it's going to have multiple centers throughout the country that are going to be part of this platform trial. So hopefully they'll be close to most patients throughout the country.
And in your opinion, is that, are we going to see more trials set up this way? Is that kind of where you think ALS research is heading?
Well, I would hope that most of the drugs that are going into a phase two program would at least consider going through the platform route, because that way they can quickly get into the clinical trial, they can quickly get to patients, and then companies can quickly get answers as to whether that's a drug that they want to take forward and spend the much larger amounts of money that they would need for a phase three trial.
Sure. It seems like a really logical approach, and hopefully one that we learn more about and see more of in the next few years. And that's a nice kind of segue into what's my last question for you, Dr. Staff. And I tend to ask this of all the research docs that we speak with. And again, everyone has a little bit different answer, but it's really just what is next. You mentioned gene therapies. We've talked about stem cells and platform trials. What do you think is going to be the next kind of key piece? Not necessarily a breakthrough or the specific treatment, but what do you think is going to be the next key piece for us to move forward in ALS research?
Yeah, well, I'm hopeful that we can get more targeted therapies for sporadic ALS. Mm. So, you know, a lot of the basic science is pointed towards some specific mechanisms that happen in everybody who gets ALS, whether it's from a genetic form of ALS or from a non-genetic form of ALS. There's some common pathways that seem to be involved for everyone. And, you know, I think if we can start to develop very targeted therapies for those end pathways, that we'll really be at the cusp of being able to understand whether we can really bend the curve of this disease early from the onset.
That's an encouraging answer to hear. And doctor, it's been so great to talk to you about this range of topics and be able to tap into your expertise. I want to thank you again for taking the time, Dr. Staff. It's so great that we have access to your mind and your knowledge at Mayo. And also thanks for everything that you do for the ALS community in terms of advocating for those living with the disease. We appreciate you being in this world.
Well, I'm happy to help out and happy to have spent some time with you this morning.
Thanks a lot. And that will conclude episode 5 of Connecting ALS. A couple of quick housekeeping items before we let you go. First, we really appreciate those of you who have found us and rated us on your favorite podcast services like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Those ratings and comments really help us grow our audience. For anyone who hasn't yet subscribed, you can visit connectingals.org and follow the links to ensure you hear from us on the second Thursday of every month. And remember, you can track us down on Facebook and Twitter and tell your smart home devices to play the pod by saying, "Hey Alexa, play the podcast Connecting ALS." This show is produced by Garrett Tiedemann from the headquarters of the ALS Association's Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota chapter in St. Paul, Minnesota. Thank you for listening, and keep an eye out for our next episode on Thursday, October 10th.